morning, everybody. This is Graham Flynn speaking, Chief Executive of Devon Insight. And today is our Sightloss Speaker Seminar for March. A bit different to our usual seminars. So, spring is in the air. And for most people, appreciation of the natural world is predominantly a visual experience. The other senses have their place, but these tend to be secondary to using eyesight. Our speaker event today is gardening by touch, sound, smell, and taste, discovering new ways of engaging with and enjoying nature as a blind or partially sighted person. And I'm going to welcome now our guest speaker, who's Andrew Hesser, and he's the man behind Brian's Quest, a website and YouTube channel dedicated to exploring the natural world from the perspective of Brian, a blind person. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. I couldn't have explained that better myself.
Well, there you are. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Andrew, your website, Brian's Quest, in the introductory page, it says that Brian's Quest exists to explore how the natural world can be experienced without having to rely on the sense of sight. How did all this begin?
Yeah. I think that I was sort of watching like David Attenborough and nature documentaries and Spring Watch and Autumn Watch and getting and quite frustrated that it's predominantly presented visually without audio description in any great detail. There is some audio description. So I thought, well, I'm missing out here. And these days people say that it's really good for our mental health and for just relaxing and well-being. So I decided to take the plunge and I joined a local conservation group, just a mainstream group, you know, not specially for anybody with a visual impairment. In fact, I was a bit, had trepidations that they would even want me there and might not appreciate that I could do perhaps more than they think. But then perhaps I was being overambitious. Anyway, I contacted the organizer and joined the group, and they had never had a blind person as part of their conservation group before. And we used to go around the small holdings in farms and do conservation work, and a lot of that is cutting back on all the invasive species and things encroaching on habitats for harvest mice and things. So it's a really stimulating day out in all weathers. Every week, a nice sociable group, and I'd get to use scythes and lothers and secateurs and things, and gradually they realized that I could do most of what everybody else could do. I just needed a little bit of guidance to you know, my patch for working on that day and things. So yeah. Then you know, out in all weathers and stuff, and I got to think, well, I've got a bit of garden. You know, that was satisfying my need to be very close to nature. You know, getting scratched by a bramble, you can't get much closer. And yeah, Learning all about the wild plants and things, it was great. And I thought, well, I've got that plot of ground next door to my house. Perhaps I could get closer to nature by actually growing things. And I looked into it. I hadn't done much growing in my life. I've been blind for most of my life. And so I'm kind of new to gardening as a blind person without very much sort of sighted gardening experience. So I wouldn't say that I'm a gardening expert, and I haven't come up through an education system of horticulture and things. So I've learned a lot. So I hope your audience are gentle with me when it comes to questions at the end.
Yeah.
Because I'll be talking mostly from my experience. But the great thing about growing plants, and I don't consider it so much as gardening as such, because that can embrace so many things, and gardening can almost seem like a chore at times, because it embraces so much. Well, I tend to focus on growing plants, and that's what I really like, and obviously that is gardening, yeah. But my focus very much is on that. So, you know, I don't get too het up or worried or concerned about landscaping and making a fabulous display, because my garden isn't for sighted people. It's for stimulating those four senses that you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah. Andrew, you've alluded to your level of sight a bit. Are you happy to share with us a little bit about your sight loss?
I don't really focus on causes and things because I'm all about, you know, I can't see anything and I haven't been able to see anything for many, many years. So that's about it, really. I want people to relate to me and maybe learn and be inspired and realize that, you know, I'm a blind person today and I'm getting on with life and learning and, you know, highlight some of the barriers that there are to gardening and growing plants without being able to see, as well as other aspects of life.
Fantastic. Have you always liked gardening?
No. not really that interested. I did help my dad. I had a bit of sight when I was young, and I'd help my dad in the garden, and he gave me a little plot, and I grew a little bit of lettuce and things, tomatoes and stuff. But it never really grabbed me, and then I dabbled after I lost my sight, and it was a bit sort of hit and miss, and I didn't really have the patience and things. And it was only really when I started that, the realization that, you know, I needed to get out and about in nature, and what better to join that conservation group. And then that kind of drew me back from the wild to cultivation and what I could actually grow. So it's quite an interesting pathway of coming from the wild to realizing that I could actually grow plants on the doorstep.
Now, there's a very interesting section on your website, and it's about non-visual nature. What do you mean by non-visual nature?
It's a sort of slightly fancy term to just, it's aimed mainly at people that can see, to realize that there are lots of ways of enjoying the natural world without being able to see, and also focusing people's attention on the fact that there aren't that many opportunities to enjoy nature when you can't see, because it's so predominantly visual with the films and nature documentaries and books and websites without descriptions of the water in the photographs, and then you'll go onto YouTube to learn how to maybe prune raspberries, and then it's predominantly people saying, well, look, you just identify one of these nodes down here, look like this, and it's all visual. There's very little audio description around, particularly on the tutoring videos and things. So the non-visual just basically means that, hey, look at all the ways in which you're enjoying nature as you can see. What about considering and supporting people by providing better resources for people that can't see? And as I went through, I don't know, this is steering slightly away from gardening and nature, grown plants, but animals. I looked at all the wild animals that I don't really know what they look like. They're referred to like wolverines and things, even the difference between a leopard and a cheetah and stuff. So I thought, well, I need to perhaps use models. And so we've had a life-size model, and I have got a life-size model of a barn owl now with some vicious claws. So I can explore that, and that's a great tactile experience. So non-visual nature means, 3D models, better audio description, anything that will draw people with visual impairments and who are blind into learning, not just learning, but enjoying and just satisfying their curiosity, just like many other people in society. And when it comes to models, it's very difficult for a vision impaired person to really understand the majesty of maybe a sprawling giant chestnut tree, for example, or a maple. A model of one of those, a sort of scaled down model, of course, of a tree. So you can tell the difference between, how does a sighted person know that that's an oak and that's a horse chestnut, you know, from a distance. You can obviously go close and look for the leaves and the bark, perhaps, but there's that whole visual aspect and descriptions of landscapes and things. We've got the lovely coastal path, both sides of Devon, miles and miles and miles of it. So you can walk it, but you're only really experiencing what's right by you. There aren't really any great descriptions about the landscapes as you go by. So that's all non-visual nature.
You know, I this is going off on a tangent. I was very fortunate enough to go to Venice recently, and I went to the Peggy Guggenheim Art Gallery, modern art. And what was amazing there is next to the Picasso painting, they had a tactile representation of the painting. So you could feel the shapes and forms that were in the painting. And I think there's so much more that we could do in museums and galleries and obviously out in parks as well.
I agree. I've been talking to the National Trust without a great deal of success, but it would be great to turn up at one of the, all of the National Trust places and expect to find a tactile map of the whole place. Now, I know some people aren't really interested in the overall layout of gardens or just, layouts of where they are. But I am a big fan. I really appreciate a good overview of somewhere I'm visiting. So to get a, like you say, that's a map of the painting in a way. So a 3D scale model of the gardens, just in simple terms, to see the pathways and know what is on display. So you might decide to go to that particular area of the garden first. I think it stimulates the brain too, rather than just people guiding you around and then you're not really getting a good overview. I'm a big fan of that. So yes, that's good.
Okay, right. Let's go talk a bit about your garden. Now, tell us about your garden.
Where to start, really? It's I like growing vegetables, so I don't really know how to describe. I suppose the size of my patch is probably about 7, 8, 10 meters by 5 meters, with a bit of lawn in the front and the back. And I've got a small a poly house. I managed to pick up a real bargain, I feel, and that's the nice thing. If you hunt around, particularly with the screen readers on the old internet, it's amazing what you can find. And I never dreamed that I would be able to afford a greenhouse as such.
Yes.
And you can get some sort of cheap ones, but they seem to be very flimsy. I don't think they would stand up to some of the winds we get in the West Country. So I found online it was just £60, and it was a 2 meter by 2.5 meter holly house. And I was a bit skeptical about how it would, how easy it was to build, and also how sturdy it would be. But it came with a really strong framework. The doors, and it has four windows in it with some very strong Velcro all around it. There's a zip door, and it's a good sort of 2 meters tall at the apex, so you can walk in it and stand up. And I was really thrilled with that, so I use that as much, and it extends the season too. If you can get something like, even if it's a cold frame, which is basically just a sort of a wooden structure, usually 2 feet tall, perhaps slightly sloping, with perspex or glass. And these days you can get some very good ones which are just very thick polythene, and it doesn't need to be clear polythene too, and it's better if it isn't, actually, because it can diffuse the light a bit in the peak of the summer. But just to have something in the garden, and it's surprising how just a little bit of sunshine really does warm up that inside these little poly houses, or the large one that I've got, really considerably. And that warms up the soil, of course, for the roots and for the atmosphere too.
Were you hit hard this winter?
No. I think it's been a pretty mild one. We've had this cold snap lately, but no.
See, I live Okehampton way, and we were down to minus 10.
Okay.
For more than a couple of days, and we've lost so much stuff in our garden. It's unbelievable, really. So we're adjusting our planting now more to where we live. So we'll talk about climate change in a minute.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of growing things in pots. I really am, and I find that really useful. I mean, everybody does it, whether they're sighted or not. But as a visually impaired person, I find that I tend to veer towards pubs and pots a lot more than perhaps I would, because it gives me a lot more control. So I can control the weeding, I can control where the plants are, so I always know. I can, you know, even rotate the tubs around if I'm thinking those at the back aren't getting quite so much sun. And these are pots from, you know, small ones, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 inch diameter, right up to some giant tubs. I invested in a pack of 130-litre very large tubs last year.
Yeah.
And I started experimenting growing runner beans in tubs, so I put a wigwam, because it's over half a metre diameter. So I put in some full-size, sort of 6 foot, just under 2 metre canes, made them a wigwam, and thought, well, I suppose you can grow anything, really. It's just like a small garden. So I had great success in growing runner beans. And also, you can control the slugs and snails a lot better if they're not in the ground. You're not in so much danger of knocking anything over as you're walking around. As I say, you can keep the weeds down. So it's like a whole different environment. So if you are lucky enough to afford larger tubs, then great. You can look for second-hand ones online or ask people locally. And then for smaller pots, I'm forever, anything that's going into the recycling, like occasionally we need to bolster the milkman who delivers with glass bottles that are recyclable with like a 4 litre milk carton from the supermarket. And I don't let that go for recycling. I cut it down halfway down and hey presto, I've got a very large plastic, very durable, reusable pot. You've got to put some drainage holes in the bottom. Just use a small one of these electric screwdrivers with a sharp end on, and then drill in a few holes, a couple around the bottom at the sides as well. And then I've got a pot, so you don't have to even spend. And I don't think I've bought a pot for many, many years because good old clotted cream containers and as I said, coleslaw containers, a bit of cottage cheese container, anything that comes along in those containers, I save, wash out, and then put holes in, and they make some great pots. I found some old at the back of the cupboard, some like paper cups, you know, the vending machine. I can't remember how I got them, and those make ideal little pots, and I can use those. At least a couple of seasons, even though they're sort of cardboard if you look after them. That's you were talking about protecting plants from the cold, and yeah. If they are in pots, you've got to be a bit careful because their roots, in the summer they can get extra hot, and in the winter they can get attacked by the frost. But by having plants in pots, it enables you to move them to a more sheltered area, and I'm not adverse to bringing things indoors, even some of the larger pots, just to protect the plants if the plants aren't too giant. Lucky enough to have a shed as well, so if there's a particular plant that feels a little bit vulnerable from frost, I'll drag it into the shed, and it's perfectly fine because it's not getting that much light in the winter anyway, so sometimes I've forgotten and go in a week later and say, oh, crikey, I haven't brought that plant back out again. But it's not really getting much light in the winter anyway, so it hasn't come to any harm in the shed. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of pots wherever possible.
Andrew, you talked a bit there about vegetables, so your runner beans and whatever. Yep. Let's stray into the area of sensory gardening. What do we mean by sensory gardening?
Just not going too much over the top, but just looking for plants that have a little bit of variety about them with regards to what kind of plants will give me some scent, what plants have some unusual shapes, perhaps it's the leaves, the branches, the growing, as it grows, does it change shape? So, and it's appreciating, if you can't, you know, admire the flowers, then why not get a lot of stimulation from the whole process of planting the seed and then germinating and then following the progress of the plant as it grows. And veg are great because they're annuals, a lot of them. So you go from tiny little seed, small seed at this time of the year or February, through to breaking up a very large plant in the autumn and chopping it up and putting it on the compost heap. And it's a really good sensation following the whole life cycle of that particular plant and going out and just spending a little bit of time. Courgettes, they're very easy to grow, easy to germinate, easy to manage. And they end up making some quite large, quite heavy when I'm digging them up at the end of the season. Some of the plants are quite heavy and they've given a lot of small and large courgettes throughout the season. So there's lots to change there because they start off as very, very delicate little seedlings and you just nurture them and check them every 2 or 3 days and just take time to appreciate the shapes. Don't just treat it as, oh, it's gardening, got to do this chore, got to do that chore. It's about enjoying the shape of the plant, the courgette plant, when it's very small and then the leaves come and then the initial leaves die back a bit and then get the next leaves coming and they've got a really rough texture that as you rub it it kind of makes a noise and then you've got the leaves grow on the end of kind of stems and those stems are hollow and round and quite bulky and quite textured too, so it's just about enjoying the shapes of those plants as well as you've got to get down on your hands and knees and you've got to check whether they're getting attacked by slugs and snails. You've got to check and do some weeding around the base of them and you've got to check whether they're moist. You've got to put some mulch around to keep them nice and damp and things. And then you've got to check whether the fruits are there and whether they need to be slightly raised off the soil so they're not going to get too damp on the underneath. So all those are good tactile experiences and also nurturing the plants as well. And then there's aromas. I love growing, big fan of beans mm. of all varieties and types. So you don't need to get too out of it. Oh, what should I grow? And, you know, looking at all the different root crops and things. I don't tend to grow many root crops, carrots or beetroot, those sorts of things. I have tried, but didn't have great success. And also, I don't enjoy it because a lot of the action's going on under the ground. And
yes,
so you're sort of, you're missing out. Because there are so many vegetables, me focusing on lots of beans and obviously the courgettes, there's so many varieties of different types of beans and things. And unless you've got a massive garden, you're going to be able to eat all those or give some of them to your neighbours. So
in this sort of energy crisis environment we're living with at the moment, I suppose that there's a lot of satisfaction to growing runner beans. I love growing beans because they're just productive for a number of months. And as you say, you have to give so many of them away. Is that part of the enjoyment of growing plants, do you think? Nurturing?
Oh, definitely the nurturing. A little bit of the giving away. I don't give away many. I'm lucky enough to have a reasonably large freezer, so it's great to stop that up and then be... defrosting your own beans later in the autumn. The nurturing, that's great. And then, you know, it is good to get a decent crop, but I don't get too disheartened anymore. I used to, because the aim was to get the crop, but now the aim is to grow the plant and enjoy the whole process. So if some things don't come to fruition very well, I can't think off the top of my head what I failed at. I've never managed to grow a cauliflower, and they never seem to come anywhere. I did lose a whole crop of cabbages when they were young because of the butterflies and the eggs and things, and then they just got eaten by the caterpillars. That's the word I'm trying to think of. The whole crop got devastated. I don't get too... That was annoying and frustrating. But I don't get too focused on, get a good crop. It's just a great bonus when you do. And then that's where the taste comes in of the four senses that we're talking about. in enjoying those crops. Broad beans, I particularly like.
Yeah.
I grow three.
Andrew, I've got to tell you, I absolutely loathe broad beans.
Okay.
They are the one food that I absolutely hate.
Okay.
Brussels sprouts, things like that, love them.
Yeah.
But there is a secret to eating broad beans when they're very young, I think, isn't it? Before the cases get quite hard.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So just for you, then, I'm going to talk a lot about broad beans because they are my favourite. And from a sensory point of view, maybe some people don't like the sort of earthy aroma you get from the plants. Even very, very young ones, when they've just about germinated and they're 2 or 3 inches tall, you sort of gently brush your hand across them and you already get the scent and you immediately know. So it's great when you're out in the garden and you know, some of the plants are quite anonymous and everything, and then you come across your broad bean rose, and I have rows and rows of them, and then you're suddenly filled with this earthy scent if you brush the leaves, and then you get that obviously throughout their life cycle. And it's good too because, it's more the shape actually. One of the fascinating things that I found is that they start off when they germinate as very round stems, and then it's not long, many weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, before those round stems start squaring up, and they end up being, I think it's maybe 4 or 5-sided, straight-sided shapes of the stems, which I find that sort of evolution of the changes of the shape. And then they're quite easy to manage because they only grow up to about a meter, maybe just over that if you're lucky. And there are lots of more dwarf varieties too. And I really enjoy digging over the ground and then putting bamboo canes like 3 meters apart. And then I tend to run a piece of string from one bean cane to the other across that 3 meter long run and put that a couple of inches above the ground and then settle that up, and then I've got a nice tray of young plants, and it's just really enjoyable to then go along that row every 30 centimeters or so and dig out a little hole and fill it with some of my own homemade compost, and then put out a little hole with my hand and then pop the plant in. And That's really nice. And then when the plants grow a little bit taller, so when they're about a foot tall, maybe 40 centimetres, then I put another string across there. So there's two parallel strings, one, a lower one and an upper one. And it doesn't always necessarily need, you don't need to necessarily tie the broad beans to those strings, but they just give it a little bit of support. And then if one is starting to sag because it's just grown so well, it's got branches going off everywhere, it can sort of bend, so then you can use some extra wire. Big fan of the rubber coated wire too, which is recyclable. Because string is, a lot of the time I don't like using string because it's just so fiddly when you can't see. But when you're doing it in a long row like that, you're not dealing with silly little pieces, you've got some long lengths. So I find that quite useful. Also find a long piece of wood, you know, maybe a 2 meter long small piece of 2x2 timber, just as a way of making sure that your rows are straight. And I might even, if I'm going along weeding or just checking plants, I might put a piece of wood down like that, so I make sure that I'm walking in an area which isn't right by the plants. Otherwise you're forever kind of worrying, am I veering off and going to sort of stamp on the base of a plant, especially when they're young. So my garden kind of look a little bit strange because it'll have a few pieces of wood or long metal posts going along, lying horizontal on the ground, separating my rows, just as a tactile clue to where the rows are. And also I use bamboo canes. I'll put in the odd one. I tend to use quite long canes at the end of some of the rows because then I can just walk along, put my hand out without needing to bend down and realize where I am. So I know that when I get to a big 6 foot cane, I know that, I'm just at the beginning of my 5 rows of broad beans and things. And then the others have just got lower canes. So I bought a big stack of 4 foot canes. quite cheaply, so I use those all the way around. You do need to be a bit careful when you can't see and you bend your head down, you could sort of stab yourself in your head or your hand or something on the top of these canes, and particularly if it's going near your face. So it's best to put some sort of protection on the tops. I have used, like old yogurt pots and things. They do blow and give a little bit of sound in the wind as well. And if it's too windy, you'll lose them over the neighbour's gardens. But so you find your own way of protecting those tops of the canes, and then everything's fine.
That's been really useful, because my next question is about that specific issue of what challenges do you face as a blind gardener?
Yeah. So we touched on that about keeping away from treading on plants and just feeling confident. I like to know where I am in the garden, and I don't have any sort of extrasensory fantastic skills as a blind person of knowing where I am or anything. It's just you just reach out and you learn, and that's the beauty of your own garden, is you lay it out and you do remember where things are. But even I will get lost in a patch and just have to be moving sort of meticulously rather than just suddenly jumping up and walking across to think, oh, I need to go over and get some more water from the water butt. But you don't just go make a beeline for the water butt. You sort of think, right, now I've got a meticulous pathway. I'll go back along these rows of broad beans, turn left along there, get to the bottom of the post there, and then turn and then get to the water butt, rather than being quite so gung-ho about the direction you're going in. If you're using secateurs, you just need to pay attention. I take cuttings and a lot of trimming back on some of the larger shrubs, particularly down the front, down the edge of the front path there. I've got some it's very tall Eleagnus and Buddleia, which just goes mad every couple of months. I'll go up a step ladder, but you just need to, like anybody would, make sure that step ladder's on a sturdy foundation, not rocking, and just pay attention to where your fingers are when you're using the secateurs or the loppers. And then you're not sort of cut lopping, because sometimes the plants are going up above my head, some of the bigger shrubs, and you're sort of cutting, so you step to the side so it's not going to fall down and land on your head. And not many other challenges, like things I don't like doing, is you've got to inspect the plants, many of plants, although for slugs. Now, broad beans, I do like broad beans again, because the slugs don't seem to get them. They don't seem to go after the runner beans once they're established, but it's during those first few weeks when a plant has gone out. But I'd go back to, again, what I do is grow all of my veg, those broad beans, the runner beans, the French beans, and you know, when you start looking online and in the catalogues, you'll see that there are virtually, you know, hundreds of varieties of all of these things. So you could grow, like I grow about five different broad bean types, and they're all slightly different sizes of plants and things, and then there are loads of different French bean types, runner beans too. So it's an endless road of discovery. You know, you don't just need to grow the same old runner beans each year or any of those things. There are different varieties. But once you find a variety that really does well in your particular soil, in your particular environment, then it's good to stick with that. And then maybe just dabble by trying a different sort. I did, last year, I did a trial of two different types of runner beans. Firestorm was one, and Armstrong, that's the other, and it was quite surprising how different they were just within the runner bean family. Anyway, we're talking about slugs, so I used to find it really heartbreaking in a way to see almost small plants getting attacked by slugs when they went out. So I keep them in pots as long as possible in the season. And then I can keep those pots up on tables and out the way. If there's a frost coming, I'd actually bring whole trayfuls of well-established runner bean plants that can be up to like 2 foot tall in trays indoors. Put them you know, just inside the kitchen and stuff, just for the night if there's going to be a frost. And likewise, it's much easier to bring them in when they're really young, not so much because of the weather, but because the slugs will be after them. So you're just guaranteed, if you can bring them indoor just for the night and bring them out the next morning, bit of a chore, but it forces you to get up and get out in the garden, because I've got 30 plants of runner beans to take back out because it's a lovely sunny day and they deserve to be outside. So they're enjoying all that warmth of sunshine, and then particularly in February, it can be really cold, as we've just said, then those same plants, although it's been warm during the day, get very cold at night, you bring them in. So it's protecting them from the weather, and also, as April and May comes along, protecting the small plants from the slugs. So when I'm putting the plants out into the ground, I try not to put anything out until the beginning of June, that they can be quite large plants. And some of them, I think, oh dear, it's a little bit pot-bound here. Perhaps I should have either potted it up or put it out earlier. But it kind of soon recovers, and they don't tend to have too much trouble, even if they are slightly pot-bound. You almost feel that the plants are sighing and cheering inside. At last, they're being released from the confines of me keeping them in these pots, and they can actually spread their roots a bit. And you can sort of tease their roots out a bit too, just to give them extra encouragement. And with the compost and then a little bit of extra fertilizer in there, within a week they're sort of flourishing. So those sorts of things, slug damage, it's very hard to sort of spot the slugs at a distance when you can't see. You've got to almost physically touch each individual plant. I remember about 3 years ago, I was really big into sunflowers. And if anybody wants to know what to grow, sow some seeds right now, get a move on and get some sunflowers. And I did those in pots, again, to protect them from slugs and stuff. But when they were out and they were about good 2 meters tall, you know, to stretch to reach the flowers at the top, which annoyingly were all facing next door because that's where the sun was shining from. So they weren't giving a nice display into our garden. It was next door. So we got the back sides of the sunflower head. But I was amazed at how the slugs really, really enjoyed scaling those tall stems of the sunflowers and hiding behind the flowers and stuff. So it's just a meticulous going through all of the plants and then finding these horrible little things and then sort of popping them into a tub. I tried using rubber gloves to do it and stuff, but no, nothing is substitute for just the tactile experience of your hands, which wasn't a very nice job at all.
Okay, Andrew. Now, before we open up for questions, I'm going to hit you with some quick-fire questions.
Ooh.
So I'm going to ramble through these. So some of these have come from people over the last couple of weeks who've rung in. So let's see how we do this. How do you tell the difference between your seed packets?
Oh, right, yeah. yeah, that brings us on to, first of all, say I'll order 10 packets of seeds that come through mail order. You can tell some by the size, because obviously broad beans, they're quite large, through to smaller seeds like spinach, they tend to be round ones. So you can sort of feel them through the packet. But to be absolutely certain and to remind yourself of what varieties you've got, I use technology. So I use my smartphone, and I've got an app called SuperSense. I've got demonstrations of that up on the YouTube channel. So you hold your phone's camera 30, 40 centimeters away from the seeds, and you zap it, and then it'll read out to you, sometimes very quickly and very easily, and other times not so much. And it might be because the seed packet's shiny. I had quite good success, though, because some of the packets are very bumpy. The, you know, runner bean and broad bean seed packets are packed full, and they're very bumpy surfaces, but eventually you can kind of pick up what they are. So that gives me the variety. The advantage there too is that once it's on in your smartphone, it's captured there and it's stored in its library. So you could actually cut and paste that information to somewhere else if you're doing a sort of garden journal and things. That's it really. Using technology. When I've identified what the seed packet is, though, I tend to use another bit of technology called a way tag, and the way tag is a label which I can write onto using my phone, and then you read it back again using the app, the Way Around Tag and Scan app. So once I've identified it with a reading app, then I'll create a label and then pop that label inside the seed packet. And because it's a technology that can read through paper to read the tag, you don't need to actually open the seed packet again. You can just scan it with your Way Around app, and it'll remind you what's in there. And you could store some other information that will tell you maybe when you should be planting it. Or what I've started doing now is labeling what the seed is, where I bought it from, and when I sowed the first lot, and then how long it took for them to germinate. So you're sort of creating a garden journal, really, on the label specifically for that particular packet of seeds.
And it's just the same technology. You sent me a photo last night of plant pot here, and it looks like it's a lollipop stick sticking in the side of the pot with this little tag that's on the top.
But yes.
That's the same technology.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's for the labelling technology. Now, I sent you that because one of the greatest things that I've discovered in the past 3 years are bulbs. And if you're looking for indoor planting, bulbs are absolutely fantastic. You sow them or plant them in the autumn, and I've been experimenting with hyacinths this year. So I was particularly pleased that picture there that I've sent you. Would you like to describe it to the audience?
Yeah, well, you've got it looks like a plastic pot, and I'm assuming it's a hyacinth. So you've got quite broad leaves that look quite thick, and then you've got your stems coming up with your yellow flowers on the top, so a flower spike, I suppose that's what it's called. It's lovely.
And would you say about 30, 40 centimetres tall? I've got the plant in front of me, so I think it's about 30 centimetres. And the thing you don't get from that, which I've got it sitting in front of me right on my desk here as you speak, is the fragrance.
Yes, of course.
As I came to sit down here, absolutely wonderful. And I had it in my on my bedroom windowsill, and it just fills the bedroom with scent. It's fantastic, and it's just one plant as well. I've got others, but this one particularly, when I've had it in my room, it's just a really, really worthwhile thing to grow, because you get that whole experience again of and it would make a very good, cheap and caring Christmas present for people if you plant up. You tend to, the rule seems to be, plant them in threes. I think it's a sort of visual thing, really, an odd number, so then you don't have to worry too much about it being symmetrical and things, because it's sort of in threes, five, seven, so odd numbers. So I put three in, and I put them quite deep, and you can't guarantee that they're going to come up, but if you do it early enough, then maybe some of the shoots are just about starting to appear, but by Christmas, it's particularly if you keep them away from the light to start with. Because then if you have them in the light, the tendency is for the green growth to grow as opposed to developing the flowers. It makes a relatively cheap present, because it's sort of caring, because you've built it, you've made it yourself, created it yourself, and then it's a present that gives back over several months. And then this time of the year, all being well, you've got a lovely display. The flowers are nice and tactile too, if you're gentle, and that aroma is just unbeatable. These that they've grown so tall, they're starting to lean over now. So if I want to preserve them a bit longer, I'm going to need to get some very thin canes, maybe 40, 50 centimetres, just very thin ones, just to give them a little bit of extra support. But the label in there, yeah. I've got the label here. Shall I read it?
Yeah, go on.
With my phone, and then if it comes over the speaker on my phone here, then it'll just give an idea of the information I've got. Because the idea of labelling these plants, I couldn't remember what type of hyacinth it is. I've bought several different types last autumn, and I've put them all in. Some have come up and done really well, others haven't so much. And I just get very confused trying to remember. And I think blind people tend to try and remember as much as possible, and I feel it overloads my brain trying to remember all this stuff, and you get frustrated if you forget. So if you can free your brain up like sighted people do and just have notes and jot things down, it just frees your mind up, and you don't need to clutter your brain like that. So I labelled these, but I genuinely last week when I thought, oh, what shall I talk about today, I couldn't remember what variety they were. So I did scan it, and then it all came back to me which ones, which then enables me to either get some more next year or just be able to tell people what to get. Now let's see if I've got my volume on my phone. Oh, right, I've got to unlock it, of course. But sorry about that. Did you want... No, I should have been doing this while you were describing the photograph.
No, you carry on.
Oh, good, unlocked. Right, got the Way Around app. Let's just get some... Get my volume up. And then should have it on speakers.
Hold the NFC reader of your phone on the way tag until... Scanner ready. Hold. Create.
Right.
Scan settings.
Right. I'll put the earpiece near the sound thing. So let me know if you can hear this. Okay.
Go for it.
Scanner ready. Hold the NFC reader of your phone on the way tag until there is sound or vibration.
Did that come out?
Yep.
Good.
One hyacinth, City of Harlem, 3 bulbs, 1st December, yellow.
Fantastic.
Could
so
you
there
hear
you are. You've got your description of the plant, when you planted it. Fantastic.
Yeah, and I couldn't actually, until you said that the flower was yellow, I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you can't be expected to remember all these colours. So, but then I didn't need to have had relied on you to say that it was yellow, describing it from the photograph earlier, because I'd forgotten that it was quite smart of me to actually put the colour, because that would have been before, that was when they were planted, you see. So that was just stuff that I'd learned from the when I placed the order. And when I chose what sort. So, yes, City of Harlem Yellow. So if anybody is looking to grow some yellow hyacinths with a really strong aroma, I can confidently recommend these Harlem ones.
Fantastic. Okay, we're down to the last quarter of an hour of the session, and I'm going to ask Jenny to unmute our callers. Now, I know that... Sure. Jenny, can you confirm you've unmuted? Not hearing Jenny yet. While I'm just nipping next door to speak to Jenny... Right. So Jenny has unmuted everybody. Is Mark on the call today? Hello, Mark. Andrew, I'm not getting Mark at the moment. He asked a question last week, which was about seasonal planting. And I'm thinking about what you might plant now and later in the year. And I think the correct term for that is succession planting. Can you just explain a bit about succession planting?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm an expert about it. I don't. I think of succession planting is just making sure that you get a continuous crop of things as you go through the year, or continuous colour if you're planting a flower border throughout the year. With vegetables, it's not about using the same plot of land over and over again, because I tend to grow one or at the maximum two types of vegetables on the same plot of ground, because you do need to leave it to give it some rest. Beans, again, back to beans, they're good because they do provide some nitrogen into the ground, which can be then used either later that season or next year, because all plants need nitrogen. So that's sort of using the same bit of land for successive crops, but for creating, say, colour throughout the year, you want to just realise and do your research, really, because it's hard to sort of tell people what plants to plant, because it's what colours they like and what they want to get from it. And it's often, and most of the literature is all about making sure you've got colour in your garden, whereas I'm not so much into colour, because I'm not gardening for sight of people, I'm gardening for growing plants for my own enjoyment. But it's basically, the challenge is to keep something in flower looking great throughout the year, so that as one type of plant's flowers fade, you've got other plants coming up, like, you know, you've got your bluebells and your what are they called?
Snowdrops.
That's them. Yeah. You've got your snowdrops, you know, quite early. Trying to think what comes out first in our garden. Ribes is a large shrub. That can be quite early on. And some of the tulips and daffodils, which those I do put outside and don't grow in pots, because they can just live outside quite happily all year long.
Okay, let's see if we've got any questions. Has anybody got a question there today?
It's Jane. I've got a little tip that Andrew might know already. Can I share that?
Go ahead, please.
Hello, Andrew. I don't know anything. I don't do gardening, but I heard this tip because I've got the aversion to slugs too. But I heard that banana skins, now you might have tried it, but apparently they don't like banana skins. But if you haven't tried it, do, then I don't know how you let us know, but it'd be interesting if that's the case, if it does help to keep them away, but you might have already tried it.
Yeah, no. What was your name? Jane, wasn't it? Yeah, no, I've not heard of banana skins. I know that I keep them away from the rest of my fruit because it tends to, indoors, keep them away because it tends to make everything ripen really quickly.
Yeah.
So maybe it's something to do with that. I will have a go. It's notoriously hard, though, to be definitive about these things, because you don't know if you weren't using the bananas, would the slugs have got them anyway? You almost need to have a pot of slugs to sort of put near your plant. So I'm just trying to think, maybe the sunflowers and things might be a thing that attracts them a lot. But yeah, I'm all up for experiments, and I love that part of gardening. So I will try that, yes. I love bananas. I love bananas too, so I'll have lots of those.
Yeah, what might help as well, it's Karen here, Andrew.
Hiya.
What I tend to do is, I know wild pink geraniums, of which I've got lots in the garden, the slugs don't like them. They don't like nasturtiums. So I try to, plant them around stalks, if you like, going up, so that it may keep them away. But can I just say, it's so nice that we've got you on Devon Insight.
Yeah. Okay.
Because last year I saw you, I still had lots of good vision then, but I saw you on Gardener's World. And I just had a smile all the way through, and especially you being up the ladder. And I felt really inspired, so thank you.
Oh,
thank
nice.
You so much. Yeah.
thanks for that feedback. Good. Yeah, that's up. I was quite surprised that's available on iPlayer for a whole year.
Yes.
And that was last April, so it's last couple of weeks, and then it'll fade into history.
Oh, well.
Thanks for your comments. That's really encouraging, even if one person just enjoyed it. And I just hope that, you know, sighted people, you know, see that and realise that even if they're losing their sight or they know somebody, encourage them to enjoy their gardening. Thanks, yeah. Karen.
And I've just set up a few of us have joined it, a Devon Journal group, Devon Journey group, once a month. You know, it's a bit like this, a phone call. But what I like is that when you're sighted, you have the big picture. You know, you go out and you see a vista, you see the hills, you see whatever.
Yes.
But when you're not sighted, it becomes much more tender, and you're running your forefinger and your thumb gently, gently along a branch. You know, like I have aces outside and I'm feeling the tiny buds of the leaves, the tiny buds. And next week, they'll be a little bit bigger, you know, and then they'll come into leaf. And there's an intimacy. It's kind of like you're in the moment.
Yes.
with that touch.
Yes, I've not used the word.
Whereas we don't touch the big picture. I mean, we love it when we see it and we've got sight.
Yeah.
But when you haven't got sight, that touch really brings this intimacy with the plant or the bush. Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you feel that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I like your word intimacy. I don't think I've ever used that in relation to that, but that describes it really, really well. Yeah, it's a lot of what I'm trying to get over to people is that business about slowing down and zooming in and like you say, we're only our focus is only at our arm's length in a way. So to be able to appreciate, like I was describing, I do that what you just said with on all my vegetable plants, partly to care for them, and then also partly to enjoy those textures and the way that, like you were just saying, they evolve during the year. A callostemon, are you familiar with? Callostemon,
No.
The bottle brush.
No.
Now that is, it can be quite a compact shrub, but its flowers are really quite firm and come out at you, and they are like a bottle brush. And that is a really nice tactile experience, and quite surprising in a shrub. I totally understand that, and. I often think, you know, I had to go through quite a long process of realizing that. I don't know how to encourage other people to get that and how you actually readjust your whole attitude towards appreciating plants. But I think everybody in the country, whether sighted or not, should have a plant nearby that they can touch, whether it's if they live in flats, an indoor one. In front of me now, I've got a Sansevieria, which common name is the snake plant, and it throws up these long snake skin-like leaves, and they're very vertical, a little bit like aloe vera, but very thin leaves. But it's a succulent, and that sits on my desk here, and you know I touch that from time to time. It's got about 10, 15. 30, 40 centimeter spikes shooting up to the sky, and just to touch those, they're like blades. Another name of it was St. George's sword, because they're like sword blades. So that tactile experience, and if you can get a little bit of aroma from time to time. So I'm touching my snake plant here with its long sword-like spikes, and then I'm getting the scent from the hyacinth, which is right next door to it. So it's stimulating both things. I just need a cup of tea to stimulate the taste buds. I must visit your garden perhaps one day, Karen, if I may, when I'm passing through Devon. That'd be really nice.
Love you too. Come and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee in the garden.
Okay, yeah. That's which part of the county?
I'm in Totnes. And actually, I'm hoping that at some point with our the Devon Journal, the Devon Journey, it's not, I mean, some people might write a journal, but, and it was interesting what you were saying about the gardening journal earlier, but how we start it is anyone in the last month on their journey, you know, what have they felt, what's touched them from the nature, and it can be something to do with, you know, we were talking from hedgehogs to horses to all sorts, owls even,
yes.
And plants, you know, and
yeah. I'd be interested in my barn owl, life-size wooden carving of the barn owl.
Yeah. Well, one of I don't know whether you know the answer to this. But one of our listeners, Sarah, said that the twit to woo of an owl is everybody thinks it's one, but it's usually two. Like one says twit, and the other says to woo. And we weren't sure. We had to kind of open it up. So we're still waiting to get the real answer about that.
Yeah, I have heard that. I don't know. Again, I don't know how to read it. Like a call and response from a male and female, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Andrew, you can get my phone number from the office. And
I'll
give permission if you ever want to give me a ring and you're passing through Totnes. Because we also have Dartings and Gardens here. That's what I was going to say. We hope to have a face-to-face meeting with our Devon Journal group, you know, a couple of months on.
Mm.
And most probably it may be at Dartington Gardens, and maybe you could come and join us.
Yeah, lovely invite. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hello, Andrew.
Hi. Hiya.
Oh, yes, good morning. Thanks for coming on and talking to us. I'm David. I live in Exmouth. I've got a very small courtyard garden. I've got it surrounded by honeysuckle, jasmine and passion fruit. I've got lots of hanging baskets, troughs, etc., etc. And the question I'd like to ask you is, what are the best plants for scent? Because I do love the smell of plants. I'm a bit lazy. I get someone to come in and do all my planting up for me, which would be in probably a month or so's time. Just like the scent of plants. Recommend any that
lilies are really good. There are some Chinese lilies and tree lilies too. I was quite surprised, but they can grow up well over a metre tall. So I won't recommend I won't recommend any names just off the top of my head, but as a group of plants, the lilies are very good.
Grow in hanging baskets, Andrew.
No, they're quite high
up off the ground. They've got to be fairly low down, haven't they?
Out of the ground, really, and they're good for sort of shooting up a bit out of the ground between other lower shrubs and plants if they can grow up to over a meter, meter tall. So yeah, tree lilies. I think you can pick up sort of small collections. I was looking at Sutton's the other week, and I think it was about £18 for a pack of nine. So that sort of idea. And that you get three different sorts then too, so that can be quite interesting.
I'll just concentrate on Lily's then when she comes in and does all the planting for me.
Yeah.
But as I say, I've mainly got hanging baskets. I've got quite a few troughs out there that are off the ground, obviously. But
these are the tree lilies, because those will give you a little bit of height too. So you're getting the scent. You're not bending down to the bedding plants and anything. Because the other thing is the herbs, of course. And I'm a big fan of mint. And I've noticed online you can get some very good mint collections. I've bought some where you get 12 different types of mint all in as plug plants, and then you bring them
off.
If you've got space to sort of pot up plug plants and you've got a gardening bench or something to do.
I've got all that.
Yeah.
I've got a garage close by as well that's on for the garden, literally. You know, it's all in to the back garden.
Yeah. And now on one of these shopping channels, I picked up a peach tree.
Ooh.
And then that might do quite well in your shelter spot if you've got a walled garden.
Yeah, it's all warm.
That has given, it's It likes lots of sun and is very, very thirsty, so watering it every day.
I get the sun all day.
Yeah, nice one, yeah. And it's it only grows up to about a metre tall. And last year I got 20. They're small, you know, compared to the Mediterranean. That's probably laugh because they're like small plum size peaches, but very, very tasty, succulent. And as the tree, all the time the tree is growing, it gives some beautiful tactile leaves, multicolored, I think. And the fruit, you can smell it when even just the buds come out in kind of May. You're starting to get that peat scent from the plant.
Oh, lovely. I recommend that.
When the buds are out, yeah. And I'm not saying, you know, it needs to be the shopping channel, but that I've not seen them in garden centres, really. So they're kind of like miniature peat trees. Yeah.
Well, this
lemon balm is, lemon balm is quite nice too.
Good one.
I've got no smell and I've got no taste, but I grow lemon balm, and you can put it. I've only got a little bit around the bottom of my rose tree, and it seems to stop the red green fly from getting on my roses, and
good.
And it also makes a very nice tea.
Ooh, from the leaves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you grow that from seed, or were they already there?
No, how did I grow? Gosh, I moved in and designed the garden 25 years ago.
Oh, okay. No. They're well established.
I don't know, really.
But you can either get...
If anybody's close or we're going to meet up, let me know and I'll bring you a root.
Mm.
Oh, wow. Oh,
yeah.
Thank you, Sophia.
It does spread very well, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you get
having it in a pot is probably a good idea.
So do you get the smell of lemon? I mean, I know you can't smell it, Sylvia, but... Visitors, do they smell
it? Not just by sitting by it, I think. If you rub against it, you do.
Yeah.
It's like the lemon geranium. I keep that in my kitchen to keep it smelling nice. Yeah.
Was it David with the walled garden, David?
Yes, it's me.
Yeah, wall flowers as well. That they can provide some nice scents. And
the thing is, it's got paid to the walls, the surrounding walls. It's all got paid to those walls.
Okay.
And I've got on one side a honeysuckle and a jasmine,
yeah.
And on the other side, which is next door's actually thing, it's a passion fruit, which comes out like these very small round things.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a fruit. They're not crab apples. It is a passion fruit, but I was a bit concerned about my guide dog maybe wanting to eat one, but he won't touch them at all.
Oh, you can eat them. People can eat them.
Yeah.
Passion fruit's lovely.
He's never tried to, sweetheart. No, he hasn't touched them. I'd hear him probably.
Oh, it wouldn't do him any harm, I'm sure. Well, I don't know. You never know. These got seeds in it, so. Just to keep him away, yeah.
I'm totally walled in, apart from loads of troughs and hanging baskets. And, well, I just repeat myself. I do like to go out there and smell all the different plants in the garden.
Yeah, maybe lavender would be something to
yeah.
Yes, I think some of that informed me last year, lavender plant.
Lavender's
yeah.
lovely. Put it under your pillow. It should give you a good sleep.
Okay.
Well, thank you for coming, Sandra. It's been very nice of you to come in and talk to us all on the Devon Insights. And I admire you. I assume you're totally blind.
That's correct.
For what
yeah.
you do.
Okay, thank you.
I admire.
That brings us nicely to the end of today's session. Andrew and I have spoken on the phone, and we're thinking that maybe we'll have Andrew back later in the year to chat to everybody. So later as the season progresses. Andrew, your website, briansquest.org, is available for people to have a look at. Is that the best way for people to find out about you?
Yes, it is. I don't focus very much on gardening there, because the Brian's Quest idea is looking at all forms of nature, which includes animals as well as plants. There is a link on there to the YouTube channel, and we didn't even talk. I mean, I was banging on about broad beans all the time. Chard is the other thing that I really love growing, and there is one called Bright Lights, and that is has multicoloured stems, so it's attractive to everybody, and it's very hardy, and I'm still picking chard now that I planted last year. It sort of seemed to have come through the winter okay. So on my YouTube channel, there is a sort of a 3 or 4 minute video in tribute of chard and extolling its virtues, and I got somebody that's a cook to recommend a few recipes for using it too. So there's a few little odds and ends of interesting gardening and general nature things to do with conservation on the YouTube channel.
Have you got something on birdsong?
No, there is a page I created on the website, but I haven't updated it lately. So no, not really. There's so many areas to
get. I know, I was just thinking that would be lovely, because if you can hear the birds, it would be nice to know exactly who's calling and what's going on in one's garden.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I totally agree. There are some other sites that will do that, and there are some apps on the phone, but I think they're a little bit hit and miss. You can point your phone to the bird that's birdsong, and it'll give you some suggestions. But I think you need to put your location in there too, and it gives you just, oh, it's likely to be a missile thrush or something. It won't sort of guarantee it. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut in because this is a time limited call, and we might get cut off.
Okay.
A couple of things to say. There are a couple of local sensory gardens that people might like to visit. Belmont Park in Exeter. It was the first garden in the UK specifically designed for blind people in 1939. So that's Belmont Park in Exeter. The Pavilions in Exmouth in July last year, they set up a new sensory garden there. So that's a good place to visit. And for those of you who've got transport, the RHS gardens at Rosemar are just stunning. I go there regularly. Now, future events. Tuesday the 28th of March, we've got a Living Well with Sight Loss event at South Moulton Library. That's Tuesday the 28th of March, and those of you who live in the area would have already received an invitation. Our next speaker events are on Tuesday the 11th of April, and that's Tackling Loneliness with Transport, the Connecting You project. And I'm delighted to have Karen Rose, who's runs the community transport service for Devon County Council. She's joining me then. And on Tuesday, the 9th of May, we've got our councillor joining us, Annie Ford. And you may remember last year we talked about issues of sleep.
Yeah. Oh, so, she was wonderful.
Yeah.
She was wonderful.
So Annie Ford will be joining us for a session that we've called All You Need Is Sleep. And that's on Tuesday, the 9th of May. So, Andrew, I just wanted to say on behalf of everybody how wonderful it's been to have you here. We'd like you to come and see us again, maybe later in the year. So on behalf of everybody, thank you. And we'll speak again soon.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, everyone.
Lovely. Thank you. And if you're sort of putting my details up anywhere, do include my email too, because I'm only too happy to receive emails with any questions or suggestions or ideas.
Well, we're hoping that there'll be a recording of this interview on the website shortly, and we'll put your contact details on there.
Perfect. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. 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 Bye.